From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. Cuba has long been one of the world's least connected countries. Cubans weren't allowed to buy personal computers until about a decade ago, and they didn't have any access to the internet until 2013. But things are slowly changing in the communist country. In December, the state telecom company launched Cuba's first mobile internet network. Then at the end of March, the government signed a deal with Google that could significantly boost speeds on the country's painfully slow network. President Miguel Díaz-Canel even opened a Twitter account. Still, Cubans face big challenges in accessing information about the outside world. So on this edition of Global Journalist, I'll look at Cuba's slow march into the digital age and what it means for the government's efforts to control access to news and information, as well as the independent journalists who provide it. To kick things off, we're joined from Havana by Hatzel Vela. He's an Emmy award-winning correspondent based in Cuba for the Miami, Florida ABC affiliate WPLG Local 10 News. Hatzel Vela, welcome to Global Journalist.
Thanks, Jason.
It's a pleasure to have you here. I was wondering if you could start out just by telling us how ordinary Cubans get news and information about the outside world today.
Well, I can tell you that has drastically changed since December of last year. Before, Cubans could go online using their cell phones at Wi-Fi spots, various spots throughout the country, and the government has made it easier for them. But since the arrival of 3G, Cubans can now navigate the internet anywhere, really, throughout the country. And that has changed the dynamic in a way that people access news and information. Before, when they used to go to Wi-Fi spots, they were limited in time. And so what they would use the internet would be to talk to friends and family abroad. Now that they have internet, generally anywhere they go, they have more liberty, more freedoms in terms of being able to access the internet for news consumption, not just for communication with their family. So we have seen a before and after when it comes to consumption of news, where now Cubans can access internet more freely.
And is there sort of a generational difference in how people access news and information, or is it that everyone is on it now?
Sure. I mean, I think you do see a gap in generational differences. And when I say that, I mean the older folks tend to consume more state-run media and what's given to them in terms of the daily newspaper, Granma, and the television broadcast news that's on a daily basis at 1 p.m. and at 8 p.m. So you see the older generation shift to that end of the of media consumption. And then the newer generation who has access to the internet is using Twitter and Facebook to consume various outlets, not just state-run media.
And we mentioned at the top of the program that the president, Miguel Díaz-Canel, he began tweeting last year. And a number of other ministers and Cuban officials are also on social media now. I mean, how is this changing how the government operates and interacts with its citizens?
Yeah, it's a very interesting shift in the way the government is working here. He was the first to urge his ministers to go on Twitter and to start a dialogue with folks here on the island. And so we've seen that. It's been really interesting because we have seen Cubans, average Cubans, take to Twitter and use Twitter as a means, not just demand, but also ask simple things about the process and their government, about what's happening with their government, about what's happening with Cuban society. That is something, a story that I think that has been underreported, because that interaction, I believe, sets a new tone in terms of openness and communication here on the island.
What about for you as a foreign reporter in Cuba? What's different about doing your job there than from what you might experience in the U.S.?
You can go and talk to the people and get their side, but when you go to the government, there's a lot of lack of information. So, for example, if you do a story, I did a story months and months ago about pipes being put in, which I think is a positive story, water pipes being put in a central Havana neighborhood, a very old neighborhood with infrastructure that's pretty old. And so the story was about the fact that they had these holes opened in the middle of the road, and people were kind of annoyed by that. They thought it was dangerous. Well, the story was really one-sided, because we reached out to the government and they promised, yeah, we could get you somebody to talk about the issue, but it's always on their time and it's going to take days. And so you never really get an answer, and the story ends up being about the frustrations of the people. Coincidentally, with that particular story, days later, and I'm not quite sure if it was the effect of the story, but days later they came and tried to fix some of the problems. I'm not sure if it was because a result of my story, but folks were happy.
Our time grows short, Hatzel, but what do you see changing over the next few years about how people in Cuba get their news and information?
I think things are going in a positive direction. And when I say that is, when you have access to the internet, now Cubans are able to consume more than just state-run media, and they can sort of compare and see what's happening in their country. I think that's a good step. I think the more internet they get, the better it's going to be for Cuban society as a whole in terms of access and understanding what's happening with daily life here in, on the island.
Well, Hatzel Vela, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
This is Global Journalist. On today's program, we're talking about Cuba's slow path to the digital age and how the communist government is trying to control the population's access to news and information online while trying to computerize its economy. To broaden our discussion now, we're going to bring in another guest who's been following this issue closely. Joining us now from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is Kenya Dworkin. She's a Cuban-born professor of Hispanic Studies at Carnegie Mellon University. Kenya Dworkin, welcome to Global Journalist.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
I want to start off just by asking you about your experience working in Cuba. I understand that you're actually blacklisted by the Cuban government. Talk to us about why that is.
Well, first I would have to explain that I was born in Cuba and my family left in 1956. So I'm actually, according to Cuba, I'm a Cuban national citizen. But in 2007, I began to do translation of a lot of written material that was produced by independent activists in Cuba regarding issues of racism and the lack of civil rights, etc. And since I was translating their stuff into English to make their stuff more accessible, and that journal, which was printed underground there or delivered there in some way or another to distribute free to people and communities, was getting in despite the government's opposition. I became a known entity associated with that kind of work, and within a couple of years, my name appeared on a blacklist of people that the government put out.
I wanted to ask you as well about sort of the growth of online independent media with actual Cuban reporters on the ground reporting there. I mean, what do you make of these different news outlets? I mean, of course, in Cuba, there are very few private companies, so advertising isn't really a way that these news outlets can support themselves. And Cubans themselves, their salaries are quite low. I think a teacher makes something like $20 or $25 a month inside Cuba. So how do these little online news sites that are popping up and trying to report on issues within Cuba, how do they support themselves?
Well, that's a really good question. First of all, there is only official media in Cuba, so there's very little that's being written and published digitally from within Cuba. So this requires collaborations with nonprofit organizations all around the world, not just the United States, but also in Spain and Holland and many Poland and many other places. And so oftentimes the people who are doing this journalism and sending their material to places that can then put it on websites that bear the names of these independent publications are being remunerated for their work. Another way is that a number of them are activists who are involved in other kinds of work that's being supported by nonprofit organizations from around the world that support either democracy work or civil rights work or racial rights work, feminist work, etc.
Overwhelmingly, the funding, it sounds like it's coming from outside, it's coming from foreigners, it's coming from the Cuban diaspora.
Yes, it's coming from the Cuban diaspora, but it's not only the Cuban diaspora. There are many, many people who support this work. So you're correct in saying that the equivalent salary could be somewhere between the equivalent in U.S. dollars to $20 to $35. And an hour of internet in Cuba, internet access, which people don't generally have at home unless they have a government job or have money to pay for it, costs about $10 an hour.
So it's out of reach for most people then, it sounds like. But I know you had mentioned that you're involved with a civil society group that is trying to push for reforms inside Cuba. And this is something the Cuban government obviously doesn't like much. So how has internet access changed the way people can organize themselves around something like this within Cuba?
Well, the internet access has come primarily through Wi-Fi access. So therefore, now there are many, many hotspots, for lack of a better word, that the government has created in public places like parks, street corners, where people can go out with their phones and get on the internet to quickly look at, read Facebook, Twitter, etc. But it has made a huge difference because I can say that in the last 3 years or so, there's been an explosion of Twitter accounts coming out of Cuba. People have been using Facebook and FaceTime. One of the issues with Facebook is that it is tracked by the government there. So actually, most recently, people are having success with using WhatsApp because WhatsApp is dual encrypted. It's encrypted at both ends. So far, that has been a safe form of communication. But you have to be subscribed to WhatsApp and signed up to be a receiver of messages like that. Nevertheless, it has made a humongous difference, and especially even in terms of visual evidence, because whereas 5 or 6 or 10 years ago, there would be events, you know, protests, arrests, etc., that would take place in public places in Cuba that one would never see a picture of from outside. And now it simply takes a smartphone to take a picture and send it around the world through a tweet.
So it sounds like there's a little bit of a cat and mouse game between the government and activists and civil society about how people communicate with each other online. Like the government, I know, blocks some applications like Skype, and yet from within Cuba, you can still use WhatsApp.
It's sort of a double-edged sword. As I said the other day, you know, when Google now has entered into a contract to improve the broadband, which is terrible, which makes it very difficult for people to download documents because it takes so much time, or to send, upload documents, then what's happening is that as the independent civil society ability to use the internet, broadly described, to do what it wants to do, then the government has increased its ability to surveil the activities. So as a matter of fact, I can tell you that there is an independent news source called Cubanet, which at the header of each time it publishes on Facebook its news, or you get it in an email, actually has a link to an independent type server app that you can download so that you can get on their website.
One thing I wanted to ask you about was the government's own use of social media as well, and government ministers, other government officials communicating with the public by Twitter. And I understand that's sort of changing the nature of how the government relates to its citizens. Can you tell us maybe a story about that?
Yeah, well, first of all, I should say that I don't think the government has the infrastructure or the personnel to really exploit digital media the way it might. So, for example, radio is still extremely important in Cuba. And also the newspaper, for example, which now, due to the growing economic crisis, has been cut in half in terms of its length. That was just announced last week. What happens is that they use social media to track other people's social media. And just very recently, I personally had an experience with a friend and colleague of mine who was there to observe some work that we helped people put together down there. And she was not only tracked and her movements were totally tracked, but she was also called for an interview with the police before she was leaving. And finally, there was an online digital campaign by a well-known rabble-rouser who's got a stage name, basically, who not only discredited her, made extremely racist and inaccurate remarks about what she was doing there, but also sent emails to her place of employment in New York.
Okay, and, so this people are using, pro-government people are using social media to troll people in Cuba.
Exactly.
As well.
Yes, but what I'm saying is I don't think the government last year made a statement about actually starting a cyber war on independent activism. But to my knowledge, even though I think it has creeped up a bit, I don't think I think they're very busy, and I think it's very busy, and I think that they don't have the, you know, the minions of trolls that can do their bidding that they might like to have. That may change. And as soon as broadband gets better and more people are getting on internet and staying on it for longer, that's just going to further their capacity to track. But people need to have access to alternative sources so that they are not tracked. And to be getting back to the issue of the price, the fact is that most people who use their phones to get on Wi-Fi at these hotspots, and they do have to pay for a Wi-Fi card to get on online on Wi-Fi, use that to stay in touch with family. So it's a minority of people, a small minority of people who are using it for this activism, and the vast majority cannot afford to do anything more than to keep in touch with family, both in Cuba and elsewhere.
Well, Kenya Dworkin, thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Thank you very much.
A reminder that you're tuned in to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. On today's program, we're talking about the spread of internet access in Cuba and the government's efforts to control news and information there as it creeps into the digital age. If you're interested in more Global Journalist, check us out online at globaljournalist.org. There you can find our archives and additional coverage of underreported international news and human rights issues. You can also like us on Facebook, where we live stream, follow us on Twitter, subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, or see our videocast on YouTube. To get a different perspective on this issue, now we're going to bring in Michael Lavers. He's the international editor at The Washington Blade, a news outlet that covers LGBT issues, not just in Washington, but also in Cuba through a partnership with a Cuban online magazine. He's going to talk to us more about that. Michael, welcome.
Thanks for having me this morning.
Michael Lavers, you've been to Cuba a number of times, and the Washington Blade works with a Cuban partner to cover LGBT issues there. What are some of the challenges your Cuban colleagues have in reporting?
Yeah, the Blade has a longstanding partnership with Tremenda Nota. It's an online independent news magazine. It covers the LGBT community in Cuba. It covers Afro-Cubans. It covers a whole host of other minority groups. And the main challenge at this point that they have is that their website is actually blocked in the country. The timing of this was very interesting. It was the day before the referendum on the country's new constitution, and the publisher of the website is pretty sure that the government decided to block access to their website in part because they published an article about a survey on attitudes towards same-sex marriage and LGBTI issues. And the reporting that they had essentially said that folks in the government, Mariela Castro, the daughter of the former president who promotes LGBT issues, knew about the survey long before its public release. And so they're pretty sure that's the reason why the government blocked their website. So that's the immediate challenge that they have. But in addition to that, they're not officially recognized by the Cuban government, and many of their reporters are harassed or even detained for simply doing their jobs as reporters. So it's a pretty difficult situation in which they're working, but they still continue.
What about for you personally? I understand that you've been to Cuba a number of times reporting, mm-hmm. and that the government keeps kind of a close eye on you when you go.
I think so. And any reporter who spent any time in Cuba will assume that they're being followed or that the government knows what they're doing. In my case example, I was on assignment in Cuba in 2017, and I spent time interviewing a very prominent critic of the government. He was a gay rights activist. He's now actually seeking asylum in Spain. But it became very clear to me very quickly that the Cuban government was following me, or at the very least knew that I was speaking to him. And the example that I'll share with you is that I called him on my Cuban cell phone a couple of hours before the interview just to confirm that we were going to be meeting. And then as I was leaving the house where I was staying, the woman who owns the house said she received a call from the government wanting to check my documents. So there's no such thing as coincidence in Cuba. That was a very clear sign to me that somebody was following me or listening to my calls, or however you want to describe it. They were definitely keeping track of me. And then on my way back to where I was staying, I was pulled over by a Cuban police officer to check my documents and things of that sort. So, and as I said, the Cuban journalists who were independent of the government face much more direct challenges than just being under surveillance, I would say.
I want to ask you as well about sort of the nature of the internet, because it played a huge role, I think, in the United States and in other countries in sort of fostering the gay rights movement and enabling people to be connected and work together towards the same goals. Is that happening in Cuba as well as, you know, internet access slowly spreads?
Just over the last few months, 3G and I think even 4G services become available. And I think to a friend of mine in Havana, who is a tour guide, and just getting access to that network on your phone just changes everything in terms of access to information, in terms of being able to confirm reservations with clients. On the other hand, it's also allows Cubans, LGBT activists and otherwise to show what's happening on the island in real time. So you're seeing folks who have access to the 3G network on their smartphones being able to broadcast examples of police cracking down on protesters or police assaulting or abusing people in the street if they're challenging the government. So you're seeing real-time information now coming out of Cuba, as opposed to before when it was much more difficult to get things out just because of the internet infrastructure. So that's one thing that you're starting to see change over time. But still, accessing the internet is a challenge. You need to have resources and money to do it, and a lot of Cubans simply don't have.
Well, Michael Lavers, thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Thank you.
This is Global Journalist. On today's program, we're talking about Cuba's slow path to the digital age and how the communist government is trying to control the population's access to news and information online while trying to computerize its economy. For more on this, we're joined now from New York by Natalie Southwick. She's the Latin America Program Coordinator at the Committee to Protect Journalists. Natalie Southwick, welcome to Global Journalist.
Great to be here. Thank you for having me.
So it seems like the Cuban government is trying to walk this tightrope where it both allows people access to the internet while also trying to control what they see and do on it. So sort of how successful are they in shaping what people are doing on the internet?
I think that's true. I think that the Cuban government, you know, recognizes the fact that pretty much everyone is connected to the internet. A lot of things in the world happen online now, and that they can't keep it off of the islands, but they are making really concerted efforts to control and to surveil and monitor what's happening online. And that, you know, affects everyone from everyday citizens that are trying to talk to family members to independent journalists who we work with here at CPJ that are trying to get a little bit outside of kind of the traditional state-sponsored media narrative and explain and report a little more on what's happening on the island, both for their fellow residents and for folks that are elsewhere. And so, you know, there's access up to a certain point. People are able to access regular services. They're able to get on Facebook, which is a huge sort of focal point of communication for many Cubans, but they are limited in what they can see. Certain websites are blocked, and the government is very vigilant about monitoring what people are able to see and what they want them to see.
Well, if I understand correctly, these Cuban sort of independent online news outlets that have popped up, many of them have reporters inside the country that are technically operating illegally, like without government accreditation. They can't go, they're not invited to press conferences or things like that. But it sounds like to some degree they are actually tolerated. The government tolerates them. So sort of like, what's the government's official policy?
Yeah, I would say for many of them, they're operating kind of extra officially. You know, they don't have that official recognition. They are not necessarily part of the accredited group of journalists, but the government isn't necessarily going out of their way to crack down on them and to throw a bunch of them in jail like they did at the beginning of the 2000s when there was much more kind of overt repression against independent journalists and independent media. The space for independent reporters has opened up considerably over the last 8 or 9 years since kind of the beginning of this decade. And we've seen much more tolerance to a certain extent for some independent reporters. So I think for the most part, a lot of them are navigating this kind of line of how far they can go, what they can report on, what they can say. You know, people do cross the line, and we've seen consequences for a lot of independent reporters that are
right, because people are still harassed and regularly arrested, right? Including just this week, I understand.
Absolutely. Earlier this week, so Augusto Cesar San Martin, who's a reporter for CubaNet, which is one of the independent outlets that's actually run from outside of Cuba but has reporters on the island, was detained by police. They raided his house. They took all of his equipment, all of his cameras, everything that he works with, detained him, interrogated him for several hours. He actually had a health emergency and went to the hospital, which is why he was released. But over the last couple of years, we've seen a pattern of journalists being detained like this for short periods of time, a couple hours up to a day. And it's a really effective strategy by the authorities to intimidate people, let them know when they've crossed a line, let their colleagues know that they're being watched, and kind of maintain this system where it's tolerated up to a certain point. But if you, you know, start asking too many questions, if you get too far into sensitive topics, you're going to run into pretty serious consequences.
So it sounds like it's sort of like a catch and release policy then. It's not like people are being thrown in a gulag for years as they were previously.
For the most part, that's true. You know, there aren't long-term detentions of journalists like there were a decade ago, which is encouraging. But, you know, these short-term detentions, interrogations, equipment seizure, obviously create a really challenging climate for journalists. They lead to a lot of self-censorship. People don't necessarily want to try to report on things if they know that they're going to face that kind of repercussions for it. So it's definitely not as severe as in the past, but there's still pretty consistent state-sponsored repression and censorship of journalists on the island.
Well, in spite of that, do you think, I mean, are you optimistic about the sort of general trajectory for the freedom of access to information in Cuba?
I don't want to speak for the Cubans, but I can say I spoke recently with Joanny Sanchez, who's one of kind of the leading bloggers. She helped found 14 Medio, which is one of the main independent outlets there and operates from on the island. And she said that despite all of the challenges that they're facing now, she's really encouraged by just the number of new outlets, new reporters, younger reporters that are starting kind of new publications, not even just on hard-hitting news, but anything they want to cover. So I think people are going to continue to find ways to do that kind of reporting, to do that work, to push those boundaries. Obviously, we would hope to see reforms to the legal structure that allows this censorship to continue. But I think that there are a lot of really creative Cuban reporters and bloggers that are going to keep kind of expanding that space for their peers and creating more opportunities for reporting on the island. So I think from the journalist side, we can look forward to a lot of new exciting projects, and we can hope that, you know, the legal institutional side will someday catch up with that.
Well, Natalie Southwick, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks again for having me. It's great to be here.
We're out of time for this edition of Global Journalist, a production of the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the Missouri School of Journalism and KBIA, Mid-Missouri Public Radio. Many thanks to Hatzel Vela, Natalie Southwick, Kenya Dworkin, and Michael Lavers. Our assistant producers this week are Seth Bodine, Lara Cumming, and Michelle Stoddard. Edom Kasae is our supervising producer. Aaron Hay is audio engineer. For all of us at Global Journalist, I'm Jason McClure. Thanks for tuning in.